Okay, well, welcome everyone to our inaugural AMC's Digital Speakers Series. My name is Dr. Dylan Bond. I'm an assistant professor of history at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and I write on the history of youth and young people in the 20th century Middle East. I'm also the program chair for AMC's, and I'm very happy that we can offer this service and this series to our members. So obviously spread the word to others out there who may be studying children and youth but are not yet members of this this growing association. So the format will be a 30-minute interview followed by question and answer. I know audio may be a little bit difficult coordinating, so if you just want to type in your questions, that's great. And you can type them in the chat bar as they come to you, and then I'll just kind of triage them if we have more people joining. So first, I want to welcome Dr. Nazan Maksoudian as our first speaker in the series. I'm going to read Nazan's bio really quickly. Nazan is a professor of history at the Free Universitat Berlin and a research associate at the Center Marc Bloch. Her research focuses on the history of children and youth with special interest in gender, sexuality, education, humanitarianism, and non-Muslims. She is the author of the wonderful 2014 book, which I have here with all my post-its here, Orphans and Destitute Children in the Late Ottoman Empire from Stanford University Press in 2014. And then the book that we will be talking about today, I should get real close there, that's a little bit better, Ottoman Children and Youth During World War I, published by Syracuse University Press in 2019. Nazan, first, congratulations on your new book, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for the invitation. I'm really, happy and proud to be the first speaker in the series.
Yes, yes. And I forgot to mention, Nazan is also an AMC's board member, and has helped us out a lot with communications, websites, things along those lines. So definitely a big part of this growing association as well. So I wanted to start, put this timer on. I wanted to start with a question that, may help sort of situate many of our listeners. Many of our listeners, including myself, as I showed you, are going to be very familiar with this book, Orphans and Destitute Children in the Late Ottoman Empire. So I was wondering if you could introduce Ottoman children and youth in World War I for readers of Destitute Children. That is, how is this book similar in theme, argumentation, thrust, sources, source usage, and also how is it different? How is it a departure from your earlier work?
Okay. Well, one thing that is very similar is kind of the idea of a chronological continuity. So the first book was actually my PhD research, which was on the 19th century, namely, so from 1860s to 1914. Why I stopped in 1914 was because, there was too much information, and I realized somehow that First World War cannot actually fit into this work. So I just left these aside. And as a postdoc research, this came kind of naturally, to go into the First World War. And it was the time, actually, the centennial. And so everything was going around the First World War. So there was this chronological push. But theoretically, of course, there's also the similarity. I still follow the same conviction that including new actors, new witnesses, new sources open up nuances in history writing. So First World War is a huge field, and social history has deepened it, of course, but with the children in center, I argued that we can see more about the First World War. And the same argument was more or less there in the earlier book, saying that, okay, 19th century Ottoman Empire, late Ottoman period is researched, for the past two decades, a lot. But then how about we look at it through the children's lenses? So these are quite similar in terms, and of course, this chronological way means that, well, maybe I should go to the interwar period, you know, to complete the circle, but then it's endless. In terms of differences, yeah, this is the more difficult question. I don't think I can offer much in that respect. I see them like really complementing each other, partially because, you know, they were conceived in a way together. One difference is, of course, the sources. So for the second book, for the First World War book, I used the German archives, which were necessary, you know, because the Ottoman Empire and the German Kaiserreich were like together in this thing. And the book has a Germany part, like in the second chapter. So in terms of source usage, there's this additional archive that I use for this book. But it is, again, very centrally on the Ottoman archival sources, you know, Prime Ministry's archives. And the fourth chapter, maybe we can say, uses more testimonies, you know, first-person narratives that I did not use so much for the first book. But in the first book, there was more literature. So it's, yeah, it's, maybe the sources can be different, this I can say.
Okay, great. And yeah, I definitely have a question later about those testimonies and kind of bringing our listeners to some of those individuals that you focus on. Of course, no one book and no author wants their book to be reduced to one word or phrase. But if I was to generalize in terms of your work in this book in particular, the word that comes to mind is agency. I just wanted you to help our listeners kind of think through this. I think this is very important to scholars of children and youth. How do you define this term? And then also, how do you find it useful for your particular topic, field, and theme?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I find really interesting, and this I became aware, you know, here in Germany, being involved with more interdisciplinary groups, discussions. You know, when I was presenting this work as, you know, kind of children's agency being very important in First World War history or in 19th century history, this was, let's say, a contribution in addition to the field in historical Middle Eastern studies discussions. But here with more interdisciplinary groups, people were like, but agency, I mean, this is, yeah, we're all convinced that everybody has agency, you know, why do you push it so much? So this was one thing really interesting for me. But still, I face it, you know, I also observe it like in present day discussions as well. For instance, with regards to Fridays for Future, you know, I see when I try to say something about youth, this youth movement from the perspective of agency, everybody tells me that, but no, you know, they're just manipulated by their parents. So then I realize it's you know, I mean, from an academic point of view, yeah, people are convinced that agency, yeah, it is there. But then in real life practices, it's difficult. And in my research, you know, or as a person in childhood and youth studies, how I see agency is not really, you know, the power to change the world, you know, it's not necessarily this autonomy or the success in getting results. But then it's one, it's quite dependent on intersectionality. So it's in relation to age, gender, collectivities. It's something that is not equally divided or not, you know, it's not something universally shared in all children and youth. It's very situational and intersectional. And second, it's also sometimes just the power to resist or endure or suffer, you know, as this feminist historians has argued long before. So it's, I do not mean to say with agency that, yeah, these children has this power to do whatever they want, you know, they change the world and this and that, but simply that they had a say on their own lives and not their decisions were necessarily manipulated by adults, you know, just remember your own childhood kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, you know, I definitely think that is something that is clear in your book is the structure during wartime and even before wartime in which agency was practiced. It's not to say, and you're definitely not making an argument for free will, especially in the context of wartime. This sort of public performance sometimes of agency, resistance or otherwise, was structured. And I think, I think that is definitely an important contribution in terms of the complexities of this sort of debate. I'm wondering also just in terms of that, obviously you have gotten some pushback at points, you know, whether, you know, and we'll get to the point on, you know, adults manipulating children and how you sort of answer those questions. But just in terms of applying the term and using it in your own work, what are some best practices for you? I mean, obviously this is a huge concept within children and youth studies. So I'm just wondering what you're cautious about when applying it. And you said, you know, it's not uniform. There may be other cases that are not your cases where it is not an applicable term. So just kind of thinking through what are your sort of, how are you cautious of the term and best practices in terms of using it analytically?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not so cautious, you know. I mean, since I used it in the context of Armenian genocide and this, you know, I mean, throughout the publication process, not only the book, but also a recent article, it's a big discussion. So can you talk about children's agency during a genocidal process? How can you say it, etc.? So yeah, I think I'm a little bit daring about using this term. And it feels to me like, you know, saying that, yeah, in certain situations, like in war, at war, or, you know, in under subjectivity, under kind of forms of slavery, etc., there's no agency. I find it impossible to accept, you know. I mean, even in this hardest situations, I see that, you know, we as humans have this, like, struggle, I mean, to survive, and the struggle to survive or the struggle to resist always comes with this. So I think I'm a little bit, I tend to see it as something of an inherent, you know, human activism. This is, yeah, I can't, and when, how can it not be used? Yeah, as said, you know, I had these discussions in different contexts, basically in this, like, different situations, difficult situations, how could it be done? Yeah, well, my thing, though, what I find interesting is that, you know, age, for instance, changes things greatly. So what I stress in the book, for instance, I mean, being a little bit older than 10 changes the game completely. And the 5-year-olds do not have the same kind of capacities in terms of resisting, doing things, etc. So in these cases, you see children as a collectivity, they act in solidarity, you need a different kind of entry point. So, or 3 years where you don't have, I mean, you neither have the sources to see what's going on, nor the activism, you know, the possibilities, abilities that to act. So I think in these cases, age and also gender factors are important. So who has agency? I mean, yeah, as a philosophical, like, postulate, I would say, yeah, we all have agency, but then a baby, you know, a younger child, this all changes the circumstances.
Absolutely. I would say, for one, I appreciate your daring approach and how unabashedly you use the term in your own work. I very much appreciate that. And I think, yeah, of course, we have to think through, okay, in particular areas of the world, certain communities, gender, whatever mode of intersectionality we are looking at, we have to consider, okay, how much agency are we talking about and how is that agency structured? But in terms of your daring approach, I really appreciate it. And I think it's, you know, it's very important. I was going to ask a chapter kind of specific question. I would say that, I mean, the chapter that most relates to my own work is the youth chapter, and I was interested in that in different ways. But I think what I was most surprised about and interested about was chapter two on the Ottoman apprentices in Germany. And I guess I was struck, and I am not a late Ottomanist. I worked in the 20th century Arab Middle East, but I was struck with how central Anvar Pasha was in dealing with the orphan apprentices, arrangements, and child policy more general. I mean, you know, I teach my modern Middle East students about Anvar Pasha in sort of like very grandiose terms. It was like one of these big figures for the late 19th, early 20th century. So that he was involved in child policy as someone who works on youth and young, I was very surprised. So I was wondering how this sort of discovery of yours helps us kind of rethink centralization and how we talk about the Ottoman Empire, and just any other insights about that finding, because I found it quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a, you know, historian of children and youth, for me, approaching any question more or less makes children very central to it, you know. I mean, it's such a selection that you see that, well, yes, I mean, the child question was really important to these guys in 1890s, 1920s, 30s, 40s. So this I can find in different places as well. And this, like, chapter two with, you know, Ottoman orphans in Germany and Enver Pasha's involvement, yes, I mean, your definition of him with this like grandiose person was really correct. I mean, in some place I think I talked about him as something like a Great Gatsby kind of person, you know, who has this like big projects, not necessarily fulfilled, but they are all big projects. And this project actually started as a project of sending 10,000 children to Germany. It in the end only amounted to 1,000 or something, but his big project was to send 10,000 children. This was huge. And yeah, I mean, and maybe this we can come back to it later, but this episode also shows a very central discussion of the period as well, that, you know, these children in the orphanages, in Ottoman orphanages, were seen as, yeah, some sort of promise, you know, there is a promise and they can be something, they can be turned into something, but the Ottoman state was somehow incapable of doing it. Mm-hmm. So I think this is it shows some weakness of centralization, you know. The country needed so much manpower, like, you know, labor, but they were not really correctly utilized as labor in different fields, you know, in agriculture, in mines, in other places. But then they were sent to Germany. But this is again related to the promise. So the promise that, you know, in Germany, they're going to get a good education and come back and, you know, rebuild the country, etc. And it goes hand in hand with the fear, you know. I mean, these like overpopulated orphanages was also fearful for the government. So there were some cases of riots, you know, children running away, and what would happen if, you know, all these like, and they weren't so young children, 14, 15, 16 year old boys, you know, start something else. What we can do about it. So it's these two things, you know. I mean, a large group of young boys who could be used, but yeah, we cannot use them. Mm-hmm. And so they are both these things. And at the center, as you said, it shows something about the centralization of the state. And yeah, in both sides. I mean, it looked like a big plan, but most of the planning was done by the Germans. So, and they were always complaining about, you know, the weaknesses of Ottoman bureaucracy. And I think the fact that they were sent away sign of weakness of, you know, this state organization.
Mm. Yeah, great. Getting back to the testimonies that were new to this book, I wanted to see, I mean, there are a lot of individuals in this book, a lot of individual children, young men, young women that we meet throughout this book. So I was wondering if you could focus on maybe one young person or you know, a few, however you want to choose that, their story and their story, their sources to exemplify some of the broader themes and argumentation of the book.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of people. And actually, I mean, first, for all the chapters, for all different like stories, you know, there are different kind of children and there are different kind of sources. So maybe just a few words about, I mean, the first chapter is mainly based on archival records, you know, how what one can find in archives, like petitions, work records, CV kind of descriptions, etc. And the second chapter on those children in Germany, it's mostly based on German masters' reports on the children, you know, how they were acting, also Ottoman sources. The third chapter is again mixed, you know, it's sometimes newspapers, but also some figures, memoirs, and the archives. And last chapter is almost entirely testimonies, you know, Armenian Genocide survivors, testimonies in different forms, I have to say. It's book, it's memoirs, autobiographies, biographies, diaries, etc. So these are all different kinds of sources. And finding one, you know, one protagonist to tell it all about you is, I think I will talk about somebody who wasn't in the book, actually. I mean, this might also be interesting to learn about, and maybe because I'm also pursuing this. So it's in 1921, the Near East Relief filmed a children's movie about the Armenian Genocide to collect donations. And in this movie, the star, I mean, the child star of the movie called Alice in Hungerland, you know, following Alice in Wonderland, is an orphan from the Jewish orphanage in Istanbul. Her name is Esther Jason. And the family, I mean, her family died during the war, and five siblings also died. And she entered the orphanage as an eight-year-old girl. And in 1921, the Near East Relief comes to Istanbul. They, you know, they make a huge survey of the city, refugees, hospitals, orphanages, etc. And they meet her in this orphanage. And all of a sudden, the film producers decide to pick her to play this part in this movie. And the movie is about an American girl called Alice coming to Istanbul to meet the father. And then the father and the child, they go to Caucasus, to the American Armenian orphanage in Gümrü. And this is the story. And all throughout the film, she meets poor Armenian orphans and offers them help. But she is this healthy, beautiful, white-dressed girl, etc. And the strange thing is that then she was adopted by these Near East Relief philanthropists. She was then called Alice. She moves to New York, becomes somebody else, etc. But the interesting part, what I find interesting is that, you know, she is just this orphan who was in an orphanage and who was very close to the fate of these, like, orphans in American Armenian orphanages who were starving, but then she becomes this like child actress. But in a sense, she was also forced to relive the experience of being in an orphanage and suffering. And all other child actors in the movie were also real orphan actors. So this, I find, I mean, what I see in the story is this complicated relationship with philanthropy, being a child, not being a child, who who is considered a child, you know, I mean, under normal circumstances, you would see this. This is too traumatic, you know. I mean, this is a child in an orphanage, already lost all the family, and now we are putting her into a position of playing again all these suffering. So yeah, I mean, maybe this wasn't so much the answer to your question, but
I just wanted you to take our listeners through some sources and individuals. I'm wondering, in that case, do we see any, can we pull out any threads as it relates to resistance, struggle, survival? I mean, of course, these individuals, these young people are reintroduced to trauma. I mean, that is a struggle in and of itself. But the theme of agency that you carry so much in the book, have you thought about that, or resistance? You know, like, do they push back up against the sort of, I don't want to say too much. Yeah, just generally speaking, those things.
No, I think, I mean, you're right. The story in itself is not so clear, because she looks like she's been pushed and pulled, you know, this kind of story. But then I go back to my own research on the First World War, and here you see, I mean, what you look at from a distance, which is discussed generally within terms of victimization and how this is a big victimization, which is the case, of course. Mm-hmm. But when you look at survivor testimonies, you see that there's the choice as well, you know. I mean, many children knocked on the doors of other Muslim families to be taken in, because they knew that conversion was a way to survive. And some choices we do, knowing that this is not the best solution, but it takes you to somewhere else. And I think in this case as well, you know, I need to go back to the sources as well, but I'm pretty much sure that this, when this Near East relief workers were in this Ortaköy Jewish orphanage, I bet all these children were striving to be picked up, to become this child actor or actress, I mean, no matter what. So you see, I mean, there are different ways of approaching the same story. And I think it's important to find her own voice in this installation.
Absolutely. Fascinating. And great that we get a preview on where your research is going. And I encourage you to continue on the chronological track, given those great sources and cases in early Turkish Republic that you have. My last question before we open up to question and answers, kind of moving more into the contemporary day, and how you end your book.
Yeah.
We kind of talked about the assumption being that often when you talk to people is that adults manipulate children or young people.
Yeah.
And that is an assumption. And of course, we see the resistance and agency through your book. But that doesn't mean the state doesn't attempt to manipulate children, of course. And you talk about that at the end of your book, how in the early Turkish Republic and in other cases, and maybe even more contemporarily, nation states and governments and private actors sort of use children and youth in this idea of empowering and, you know, finding a space for them and nurturing them up to the point in which they begin to call them reckless pawns, these types of ideas, more or less.
Yeah,
passive pawns, reckless, etc. And it's a thing that I'm fascinated with, you know, like how the state kind of plays this double game of empowering until you can't control them anymore, and then you start to use this sort of pejorative language to talk about young people and children. Yeah. So I'm wondering, because you end the book with that as sort of a jumping off point. So I'm wondering, we could either talk about this in the context of the early Turkish Republic, and I'd be very interested for our non-historians if you could speak of this in the context of contemporary Turkey at all.
I would
love that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this discussion is also very much informed with contemporary Turkish discussions too, you know. I mean, Yeah, I've written the conclusion sometime after that, but then, you know, what happened after 2010, all around the Middle East, including Turkey, was also within the same discussion. So we see, how I see this is the following. I mean, political agency is found to be dangerous when it is with young people. So young people, again, going back to the point that I made before, young people for governments, you know, for the ruling elite, are of course a promise. And so they want to go into this promise. Different kinds of mobilizations, and how can they be mobilized, you know, for our purposes, for our state resources, etc. But then when it's a self-developing kind of political agency, not necessarily connected to the center, in a way oppositional, then it's very quickly interpreted as one manipulated by, you know, adults or other dangerous classes or dangerous groups, and so this cannot be tolerated kind of thing. Or else from another perspective, you know, this also happened in the Turkish case as well. Those who are close to these children also kind of want to deny this kind of political agency, saying that, yeah, what they're doing is not really political, you know, it's about personal space, it's for the nature, it's for this, it's for that. So there are these two things. I mean, on the one side, like more suppressive states want to see the political activism entirely as terror, and the more sympathetic observers also want to take the politics away from this mobilization. And this I find very interesting. And it again goes back to the same discussion, being like youth in danger, so let's do something about them, or dangerous youth, you know, how do you see this? And it is, yeah, I think it's again this struggle between an adult and a young person. And this is, it's also strange that, you know, all these discussions are done by us, you know, maybe you are younger, but I know that I'm no longer young, but I see that it's something else, you know, as young people, I see when I look at, for instance, the Gezi movement, you know, which was not long ago, just 7 years ago, or Fridays for Future now, I see so much more hope and action and the belief that the world can be changed. And I think these are like beliefs and concepts that you have as a young person and you lose them on the way, which is a pity, but it happens. And then all these discussions have this like adultism kind of thing, you know, oh no, they don't know anything, you know, they're just young, they're just children. And this is really disturbing, knowing that we've been there, we've seen it kind of thing.
Well, thank you. I think at this point, we'll open it up for audience questions. I'd be okay with the microphones as long as we know the audio is okay. But you could also type in your questions. Either or. So any questions for Nazan regarding her book or broader research?
Hi, Nazan. Thank you so much for your interview. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you, Heidi.
Hi. Sorry, I fell off for about 10 minutes. The internet went out. Excuse me if I missed this, but I was wondering if you could share some examples of the agency. I'm apologist if I missed this, like some of the you talk about in your book, or the songs or these sort of very small manifestations of agency.
Mm-hmm. Did you catch that, Nazan? Manifestations of agency in particular examples? I don't think we did get into that as much as
No, we didn't get. Yeah, can you maybe say it again for me, Dylan? Because Heidi's voice was not entirely there for me.
So manifestations of agency are sort of examples from the book where mm-hmm. we actually see yeah. agents that yeah. agency that you conceptualize, that you describe yeah. A particular episode yeah. or case where yeah. you can point that out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, different chapters have different stories and so different forms. But all in all, I think what I stress too much is kind of resistance and struggle. For instance, in the first chapter that is about orphans in orphanages in Ottoman cities, the most recurrent use of agency was to escape or forms of riot and things like that. And in the second case, you know, in this like Berlin thing, we see different kinds of examples of children coming together and starting a protest in a mine they were working, for instance. So in their case, the circumstances were much more difficult. They did. Their circumstances were much more difficult. They didn't know German. They were in a foreign country. But still, when they were in the same workspace and this mines, I mean, they had no idea that they were going to be sent to mines. So they organized some forms of, you know, basically revolt. And in the Armenians, I mean, Armenian genocide survivors, as I said, what I see as agency is not then necessarily revolt, resist, you know, openly speak up. But sometimes it's, again, I discuss conversion, for instance, or getting into a Muslim household, that it can be seen from the perspective of agency when you look at their own narratives. Mm-hmm. But it's usually escape, changing houses, you know, and so this constant change, and sometimes they go to an orphanage and sometimes they escape this orphanage again. So you have all these changing decisions that they take. Yeah.
Great.
Don't you also include in your book, like, you acknowledge and recognize small forms like play on a playground and like ways of finding happiness that kids use, if I remember correctly?
So play and happiness as, yeah. as forms of agency. Like, you know, basically, yeah. yeah, like proving their humanity that, you know, even in these terrible situations. But yeah. I wonder if you can speak the role of play in your book and yeah, as it relates to agency as well.
Yeah, I think this I found something very remarkable as well in this like survival narratives, that you have the explanation of games, plays, friendship, solidarity. This I found really fascinating, and it's all this play and friendship were also like ways to deal with trauma, find the strength to fight back, and maybe not directly agency as such, but I put them under resilience, which is similar, you know. I mean, all these activities gave children the resilience to go on with. And it's, again, it's kind of quite evolutionary in a sense. I mean, you know, from one perspective, from one ethical, moral perspective, there's a lot of shame on it, you know, to survive. We know this from Holocaust studies, how survival is shameful and how living, no matter what happened, going on living, and you see this kind of descriptions as well, but still children's activities were giving them strength to assume agency as well.
Thanks, I really appreciate your giving this talk and also your nuanced interpretation of agency, embodying things like resistance and resilience at the same time.
Thanks, Heidi.
Other questions?
Hi. I'm going to share my question. I'm going to share my question on text, just so the nuances are not lost. If I can get my copy and paste to work.
Great.
And I'll also introduce it. Hang on, my computer is like not. It's my cat.
She's I like the cat. I like the kid and the cat.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, this is a children and youth studies digital speaker series. I mean, it's good we have some kids in the mix, even if only for a moment. Otherwise, it's just adults talking about kids again, even if it is favorable.
And I dropped my son off at preschool.
Okay, so the paste is not working. Can you hear me? Is that maybe that'll be enough?
Yeah,
I hear you well.
So I'm really interested in continuities. I echo Heidi in really appreciating the nuances that you bring to questions of historical agency. And my question is about Syria historically, but I also think that in doing your work on agency that you've done, you give us an opening to think continuities in a very specific way, namely the relationship between financial capitalism, class, and resistance. Mm-hmm. My fieldwork is with war children in the Baqa, and my ethnography of them as they survive and get out and move to Germany as well, is that structures such as banks become an incredibly important structure to survive, right? Flows of financial capital are what provide, you know, the material foundation for their survival. And so I'm wondering about the history of global financial banking in your story, and in particular, the creation in 1963 of the Ottoman National Banking System, and then the imposition of the national banking structures in the state during World War I in the aftermath of the League of Nations. And if you've seen a relationship between the increased financialization of personhood and the capacity, as you were saying, of these young people to act in collective, as class or as individuals or whatever. Is there a change that you've observed in the historical records as banks become an increasingly important mediation in people's lives?
Wow. Well, I mean, this is a fascinating question, but honestly, I don't think I know so much about, you know, the financial history of Turkey or the Ottoman Empire as well. I was even thinking, you know, what is the economic dimension in my discussion? Maybe I can say a few words about what I have, you know, in terms of economics. But again, this won't be a clear answer to your question. Well, in the case of those children sent to Germany, we see some financial concerns, meaning that these children are sent as apprentices, and so they weren't entitled to any money. And this, in the first few months, started really a surprise and shock, because the children in Istanbul were told that they're being sent to Germany to work in factories and that they will get salaries. But in the end, they were put into small workshops or mines or agricultural fields, and they were called apprentices, Lehrlinge, and so they weren't entitled to any financial compensation. This was a shock, for instance. And how I see, you know, as I said, Ottomans want to send the children because they were kind of a burden for the Ottoman states. But why the Germans accepted them? They accepted them because it was free labor. And yeah, free labor was something valuable at the time because everybody was conscripted, the labor. And in 1917, of course, Germany was like burning with the coming, I mean, the possible revolution. And so you see how these poor orphan Ottoman free labor can be used to stop the possible workers' revolution. So that was kind of there. But then the numbers were not so high. I mean, 1,000 children is not so big. So this is the balance.
I mean, it wasn't
and
big.
It's in the case.
Yeah. Mm, sorry.
I didn't hear you.
No, I'm so sorry. Continue. I was getting excited. It's okay.
Okay. And in the case of the Armenian genocide, of course, what I found interesting was that in certain places in Adana, where you had trees, were usually sock or carpet producing places, the Armenians could be saved from being deported because the factory owners or the governors or both were concerned about the workforce and skilled work. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, also very interesting in terms of genocide research because we know that, yeah, you can save yourself sometimes with bribes, financial promises, etc. But it was usually very uncertain. But in this case, those factory workers in different places, in Hereke, in Adana, in other places, could be saved because their work, their skills were appreciated. And this is, again, something that is not so much discussed, but the economic factor is definitely there. Yeah.
That's so my first of all, thank you. Those two points are really appreciated and precisely do actually get at my question, albeit from another direction. If I can ask one follow-up, it would
sure.
be, you know, the couple of thousands or the thousand of children that move that are sent from Ottoman Empire to Turkey was only just 1,000 from that region. But I'm wondering in the like larger perspective of flows of young children and then the bodies for free labor that they become, if there might not have been a historical moment at that particular moment that while your children only constitute 1,000 of the labor force, there might not have been a larger sort of movement and flow of bodies. And then the follow-up to the genocide question would be, yeah, saving self with work. What kind of work is that? The saving of the self with a mode of work that is not quite the same kind of work that the German state is forcing these young bodies to do. And I wonder if there's a difference in how you're conceptualizing work in those two instances.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, these are both great follow-ups. And yeah, movement of bodies, this is absolutely great. I mean, in the first case, of course, the what was unlucky for all the three parties involved, I mean, the Ottoman state, the German state, and the children themselves, that the war ended in a year and a half. So what they wanted to achieve was actually not achieved. This is the strange situation. And in the case of the second follow-up, you know, saving yourself with your work, yeah, this is an incredible interpretation. I think this is very much the case. And it also speaks to other cases. You know, I have examples of children in the fourth chapter, introducing themselves as former apprentices to a pharmacist, which would also sometimes save them because medical knowledge was appreciated, or other such examples. And this is exactly where, you know, your knowledge or skills were helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Our next project?
Yeah, next project. Heidi, I think you may have missed parts of that. But yeah, talk more about. But yeah, with the, because is that your next project?
No, it's okay. What I talked about is something like a side project. It's not the next project or like current project. My current project is about the 30s, 1930s, Turkey, and the arrival of Jewish German exiles from Germany to the universities in Istanbul and Ankara, and the sending of PhD students to Germany in the 30s again, and the development of what I called child sciences. And here child sciences are anthropology, pediatrics, child psychology, and pedagogy. And I look at different kinds of research done on children. So I work on intelligence tests, anthropometric measurements, child mortality, learning practices, etc. So this time, I think it's not going to be so much about agency. Now I try to understand how this new republic conceived children in its social, or natural scientific fields.
I also think it's interesting, and I don't know if this is deliberate. So your first work, at least in title, is almost exclusively on children, even though deal with people that wouldn't be classified as children by an age basis. Your current book is more on sort of the in between, and kind of moves towards youth, both conceptually in terms of using that term more often. And then it seems like in this new project, at least the main actors, even if they're talking about children, are going to be young students. So I'm wondering, is this just coincidence, or is this just, and especially as someone who is more on the youth side of the children and youth, I like hearing this. No, I'm just kidding. But is this a coincidence, or do you see yourself kind of moving toward more towards the youth aspect of your work?
Yeah, one part of it is coincidence, of course, and also the fact that I'm in Germany and I want to stay in Germany, and where a researcher is based, of course, always determines certain things about the research. It's the archives, the sources, the audience, what you produce, etc. So just like my German episode brings about more German involvement. That's one thing, definitely. And in terms of moving forward, when I was writing this PhD about the orphans and destitute children, once I gave a talk about abandoned babies, chapter one of the first book, and somebody told me, Nazan, I know that you don't have a child. And I said, yeah, I don't. And she said, well, somebody with a child cannot work with such sad stories, something like that. And I thought, yeah, okay. But then in time, when I go back to my research, I really find it sad. In time, as you get older, I think you lose some parts of the toughness. But I don't think these like 30s intelligence tests, etc., it's not going to be so nice either. No. So.
Any other questions? Okay, well, Nazan, I want to thank you so much for being our inaugural speaker. Thank you very much. And for those who came to listen in, really appreciate that. Really appreciate your questions. I just wanted to say real quickly, our next speaker event in the Digital Authors Series is Friday, March 27th. It'll be an hour earlier than this one. And it's from Dr. Chiara Diana, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Université Libre de Bruxelles, author of a new article, Legitimizing Child Martyrdom, The Emergence of a New Political Subjectivity in Revolutionary Egypt. That's Mediterranean Politics 2019. So that should be a very interesting discussion as well, and hope to see you all here if possible in our digital space and invite others along. Again, Nazan, thank you so much and really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dylan, for all these like wonderful questions. And thanks, Tori and Heidi, for your questions as well. I really enjoyed it. And I'm sorry that it's, you know, it's late here in Berlin. Maybe I was slow in my answers, etc. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to turn off the recording.